WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Dennis Smith. For 18 years, he served as a firefighter in New York City. He wrote about his experiences in the South Bronx, and the result was the best-selling book, Report from Engine Company 82. Smith retired from firefighting to edit his own national magazine, Firehouse. He's chairman of the New York Academy of Art and is an honorary fire chief of the New York Fire Department. His new book is called Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Leanne.
There are so many stories in this book, stories of urban firefighters, rural firefighters, volunteer, forest service, women, blacks. How did you choose the stories?
Well, I went from city to city, and of course I know, I've been going from city to city for now 15 years, and I know firefighters all over the country. Then I have an exceptional staff who works for with me at Firehouse Magazine. And they were helpful in identifying the right people. I chose them because of my confidence in other people. I would ask other people, look, I need to talk to somebody who's straight. I didn't want any local color heroes. I didn't want any, you know, those people who had popped their heads up for one reason or another. I wanted to represent the real average Joe, so to speak, firefighter, but yet people who have had very particular experiences. Mm-hmm. And so as I went from city to city, I met these people. I was very moved by two things. Number one was the great humility that comes forth, and because I had to exact from them, I mean, every single moment of drama, because they were not, it's not that they were normally reticent, it's just not anything they would talk about. And the other thing that struck me as very, very interesting was the reverence with which they talk, because there's so little eschatology in this book that, I mean, I thought that we could sell it to the Christian book club, you know, I mean, it's just a wonder, because you would think of firefighters as being tough men and women, you know, and but they do talk with a special kind of respect for what it is that they do. And no matter what I try to do, because I don't curse very much, I never did in my whole life, but I would even gratuitously throw a cuss word in once in a while to make them feel perhaps at home. But yet the language was very straightforward and very direct. And
didn't they find it easy to talk to you, though? I mean, you are a firefighter. You have had some of similar experiences.
Yes, I don't think that anyone else except a firefighter could have done what I have accomplished in this book. And I don't say that with a sense of egocentricity. I just think that any firefighter could have done it if the person to whom he was talking knew that he was a firefighter and respected the person for firefighting. I do think it's in kind of an in-group confidence that permitted people to talk so spontaneously.
It's interesting to translate what they've said into print and now to talk about it, because you mentioned that firefighters rarely explain or describe what has happened to them, even to the fellows in their own engine company. It's a look that they give to one another. So there's this immediate camaraderie. It's almost like veterans of a war.
It is. In many ways, I could just tell you, I had the very happy privilege yesterday of talking to Vice President Bush.
I noticed your cufflinks. They're a gift from him, yes?
Yes, he gave me these cufflinks. But and I talked to him mostly about federal problems relating to firefighting in America. But one of the things that was very conscious of is that firefighters are very much like, and that he would understand, firefighters are very much like combat troops. That is, that they need leadership, that if they are competently trained, you know, they are going to respect each other and they're going to rely on each other, and they need leadership and direction. And they don't want to be led on a garden rosy path ever.
Well, because of the situation that they're in.
Exactly.
It's life or death, isn't it?
It's life and death, but particularly, there are lots of life and death situations in life, I must say, but in firefighting, it really depends on seconds. So you don't have an awful lot of time to be analytical in firefighting. You have to account immediately on your recall and experience.
And you need someone who can marshal the troops, analyze the situation, and then do what needs to be done. It's split second.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I was surprised to learn that the training for firefighters is generally only about 12 weeks. I mean, that's summer camp, isn't it?
It is, but you must think of that in relation to the rest of the training they do every day. I mean, every day a firefighter's in the firehouse, there is a training period. And so you're continually going over the skills that you have. I mean, this, you know, to deal with hose and to deal with ventilation, the science of ventilation, where you put a hole in the roof, or what windows you break, and for what reason, depending where the fire is and the volume of fire, and depending where the other firefighters are with the hose, all of these things come into play. Search procedures, you know, rescue procedures, hose, different kinds of connections that are used in water hydraulics, different kinds of pressures that are involved. The list is just endless of things that you have to know, but they're all fairly fundamental. You know, there's just a lot of them. Mm. And in that, some places it's 12 weeks, other places it's 14, 16 weeks, depending. Mm.
But you call it school is okay, but experience is really the teacher. That first fire. Many of the stories that you have in your book are about people's first fire.
Yeah, and it also depends on the people with whom you're working. I think that you have to rely an awful lot on the people you're with, so that those first fires, if you're with a really good firefighter who cares about you and guides you in, you know, inch by inch, and gives you motivation and enthusiasm all the way, then I think it's really helpful, and you carry that with you the rest of your life.
Can you tell us why they called you U-turn Smith? It was your story of your own first fire.
Oh, it was just that we were just going into a building in the South Bronx. There were several apartments, rooms on fire, and as we were going in, I knocked it, what we call knock down. You know, you extinguish the fire in one room. And but the fire was really very hot, and as we were going through, we were on our really knees and soles of our feet, like that, going, trying to get through as quickly as we can to the next two or three rooms of fire. And suddenly the ceiling collapsed. So as the ceiling collapsed, it didn't collapse so that it hurt any of us. We collapsed in lots and little pieces, and these embers just went right down my back, into my open collar and down my back, and so it was, I was pretty severely burned then, but it hurt a lot, I gotta say. So I immediately spun around and started going the other way, and so they called it the U-turn approach to firefighting, you know.
So. You speak about getting hurt so dispassionately.
Well, it's a long time ago, number one, And number two, there's a story in this book about somebody says, I'm not quite sure where, about getting hurt is just part of the job, and that you can't expect to do this job without getting hurt. That ultimately, sometime you got to get hurt. Now, if there's a safety officer in some fire department listening, he'll be furious with me now for saying this, because ideally, if a firefighter is safety minded, he shouldn't get hurt. Because most of the, in firefighting, you know, suffers more deaths in the line of duty than any other occupation. And a lot of those deaths could be cut down because a lot of them are predictable, and it takes knowledge and experience. I mean, before a wall falls, there are normally indicators that the wall is going to fall, or a ceiling, before a fire flashes over. some firefighters die because they haven't had adequate training on the use of masks. And, you know, they think you just put a mask on, you go into a burning environment, and that's, when the mask runs out, but sometimes it malfunctions, or sometimes the air-expiring bell won't ring, or whatever. And you have to be trained in order to deal with that, because it's a long time to get back out into free air, and sometimes they don't make it.
Yeah. Where do they get the discipline to just keep from running away? I mean, this is so dangerous.
Well, I think that it takes a lot of experience. And I don't think that you're ever quite transcend the fundamental fear of fire. Or it's not really a fire, quite frankly, Leanne. It's just the fear of dying. I think it doesn't really matter what you're doing. It's just the fact that the possibility of dying is in, there is an innate apprehension. And you get over that, never quite. But you do learn to deal with it as time goes on, with experience and learning how to operate in those environments. A few weeks ago, I was up at this at the funeral of these five firefighters who died in the Hackensack, in an auto showroom in Hackensack, New Jersey. And as a good example, I watched the complete videotape of that fire, which was about 45 minutes long before they had the fire under control. And the fact that these folks, men, went into this building, and the fire was pretty substantial, you know, and so you knew that the environment was dangerous. Now, the roof came in. Were there indications that the roof was going to come in under such fire conditions? I mean, I don't know, and I'm sure that some investigatory body will determine that. But, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of litigation when five people die in a fire like that. But the fact is that these firefighters knew that there was a danger in that building, but they were there nonetheless, because that's, you know, we fight fires from the interior, and the reason we do that is because we try to save the buildings. Now, there are 2.5 million fires in America every year. If we just fought all these fires from the outside, I mean, we now have $7 billion worth of property damage in America. If we changed our tactics, we would have maybe $100, $200 billion in damage a year. So we save the buildings, and that's the whole point of firefighting. I mean, it is a fight. It's not a containment. You fight it. You try to conquer it as beginning a stage as possible.
My guest is Dennis Smith. His book is Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. You talk about saving buildings. Another task that firefighters are often faced with is saving people. Going into a building that looks dangerous, that might collapse on them, that might burn them severely, to rescue someone.
Well, you know, there are all kinds of situations. I interviewed one firefighter in Philadelphia. Henderson was his name. A black firefighter. He was working with a white partner, and they were called to a collapse. They were assigned to the paramedic squad, the ambulance. They're Philadelphia firefighters. And they were sent to a building collapse in Philadelphia. And they pull up, and there's a woman outside the building, a black woman, yelling, "My baby is in there, my baby." So they, both of them, go running into the building, right? And the building's completely collapsed, and it's being held up like a deck of cards. I mean, at any given time, a splinter could break, and this building could just collapse more completely. So they go into this building, and they find a little child, about 2 years old, and it's still conscious and everything, and it's caught in the corner with debris. And so they pick the child up, and they bring it out, and they give it to the woman. The woman says, "That's not my baby." So I mean, it's funny when you think about it. That's not my baby. So, of course, they gave the baby to somebody, and then they go back into the... Now, in the meantime, there was a helicopter that came and started hovering above, and the chief got there and was in charge of the fire, and these two guys were the only persons that were permitted in this environment. And it's called... and they were doing a search to find this... baby, and they knew that they were in there too long, and Henderson said to his partner, "I think that, you know, we're here much too long. We better get out of here," because it was very, very tenuous. And the partner said, "You know, if there's a baby in this building and we leave it, I'll never be able to live with myself." And so they continued the search. And finally, they stepped on a door that had fallen down. And as they stepped on the door, the baby screamed, because the baby was underneath the door. So they picked the door up, got the baby, and brought the baby out to the waiting woman in the street. And Henderson said, you know, it was a great moment for him because, number one, he always got along well with his partner and he really believed that they cared for each other. But here they are. Henderson's a black man and the partner's a white man. The baby was black. Henderson was thought that they were in terrific critical danger, and the partner said, see, it transcended color or transcended anything except the fact that there was a human life at stake and he wasn't going to leave it. So...
amazing story. My guest is Dennis Smith. He is the author of Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. I want to talk to you more about this profession of firefighting after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is former firefighter Dennis Smith, author of the best-selling report from Engine Company 82. His new book is called Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. You've related the story of a rescue of a baby who made it, but there are a lot of victims of fires that don't make it. And the firefighters have to deal with that because death is a fact of their life. Are there any psychologists or people that they can talk to help them deal with this?
There are. Yeah, and the fire service is very stress conscious nowadays. And as a matter of fact, there are critical incident stress debriefing teams that exist in various parts of the country. University of Maryland is very active in this, where they, you know, the firefighters I talked to who was at the terrible plane crash in Detroit where they found the little girl in the chair.
Yeah.
Well, I talked to that firefighter who found her. And he was saying that the stress debriefing team came in and he talked to the person, but he wasn't interested at all in what the person was saying because the person had no fire understanding, no experience as a firefighter, no understanding of firefighting, no understanding of the culture and the traditions, the history. And so they weren't influenced at all by that person, but yet they understood that they needed some critical stress debriefing because that was terrible carnage that these men and women had to deal with in that plane crash. Another incident was in the Hackensack fire. They knew immediately that they had these folks dead in this building, and so the stress psychiatrist was asked to come in while the fire was still. It was out, but it wasn't completely over yet, you know. And he came in and he told the Hackensack firefighters with whom these five men were working that they should not go in. That they should stay out of that building and not go in again. But now, you see, that fella, while he understood psychology, did not understand the culture of the fire department because when it's one of your own company that is caught in a collapse or and you have to go in and find the body and take the body out, that's your responsibility. I mean, it's, you know, and it would be worse if you didn't meet your responsibility in the culture of the firefighting tradition. So the answer is yes, we do. We are very cognizant of the need for stress help. But that help has got to still be developed so that the help is provided by people who really understand firefighting.
Do you think this is a symptom, essentially, of the way that firefighters are treated by I guess politicians, by the public? It's a civil service job, so it's got to be the victim of politics and budget cuts and to a certain extent a lack of understanding about what the daily job of a firefighter is.
I think that firefighters don't get a great shake from the municipalities they work for. And volunteer firefighters, on the other hand, very often are thought indifferently by the are thought of indifferently by the public they serve. I don't think it's a great problem, I must say. I think that there are more significant problems that firefighters face than this kind of one of public relations. Problems of hazardous material, problems of equipment safety, those kinds of things are certainly much more important. to the firefighters' interests.
But with cities cutting budgets, do they have access to the kind of equipment, say, the kind of equipment that you advertise, essentially, in your magazine, Firehouse? It's all state-of-the-art stuff.
It is indeed, yeah. No, and there are lots of fire. I mean, most fire departments today are still operating without personal alerting devices, which is the device, if you're in a building collapse and your body does not move for 10 seconds, this device emits a very loud signal. And it's waterproof and all those things that you would expect it to be. And in New York City, every firefighter wears one. In some cities, some departments, only the person who has a mask, it's attached to the mask. And so the city couldn't afford to give every firefighter one. But I think ultimately every firefighter ought to wear one of these things on his person when he's in a dangerous environment. Those kinds of things exist. And the the firefighter, I think, as a political constituency, in most cases, have not really banded together to use their influence as a part of a voting public. There are 1.5 million, 1,500,000 firefighters in America, and I suppose with their families, there are about 3 million votes. And the surveys show that firefighters vote with great predictability, about 90%, which is very high as a group. So there's considerable amount of voting power out there. The problems of firefighters are not so much personal problems, but they're problems that ultimately relate to the public safety. You know, I mean, as a firefighter is better trained, as the National Fire Academy is made more relevant to the firefighters' needs, ultimately the firefighter is better trained, but the public is better protected. So this is not a kind of a selfish self-interest that this group has, but it's kind of for the larger good. There should be some movement there.
Was this sort of moving personally for you, a former firefighter in the South Bronx? You know, had to put on the rubber boots and the rubber coat and the helmet and all, dressing up in a white shirt and a blue tie with fire helmets, red fire helmets all over it, and meeting the Vice President of the United States?
Yeah, it was a big deal. I had been in the Oval Office, actually, when Jimmy Carter was president, and had met with him. But now I want to meet with the candidates, and I can do that because I am the editor-in-chief of Firehouse Magazine, which reaches so many people, and so that gives me a certain kind of entree. And I was very honored by that. I mean, and I couldn't help thinking that, of course, I have an extraordinary sense of my own past. You know, I quit high school when I was a guy. I never went to high school. And I did manage to go to college in later years, but I skipped completely the high school years. I just quit and went to work. And so here I was, a high school dropout, sitting in the office with the Vice President of the United States, and it was a great honor. And I couldn't help thinking during that period of time, when I was a little boy, about 6 years old, the thought occurred to me, as with my mother and my brother, huddled on the fire escape of the tenement where we lived on 56th Street in Manhattan, and there was a fire in our old tenement building somewhere. And I couldn't help thinking about that even if the house burned up, my mother had to be thinking at that moment. Her only job in life was to protect her two children, and she had nothing. I mean, if the apartment burned up, you know, there was nothing of value to lose, you know? And as long as she had her children out in the fire escape, that's all I'm sure she cared about. Maybe some photographs or something that would have some sentimental value, but we never had anything. So it was a long, and particularly being like the firefighters would move past us and go up and down the fire escapes in various parts of this building because it was on fire. So this juxtaposition with the firefighters there on the fire escape and knowing that my mother was, you know, in risk of losing her everything that she owned, which wasn't anything anyway, and then sitting here with the Vice President, I thought that that was a long road. It was a very American road. I don't think that that you can make the kinds of travels that I've made in my life in any other country. I think America is wonderful in this way, that it doesn't matter if you're the child of an immigrant, as I am, or, you know, if you were born in a welfare apartment in the South as to very poor people as Jesse Jackson was, or it doesn't matter, but this country will provide if you want to work for what you want.
Do you miss firefighting?
Yeah, I do. I miss a lot not so much the firehouse work, you know, I mean, a lot of that I found very tedious, but...
Washing the windows, polishing...
Yeah, that kind of thing. Even building inspections and things, which are important, but it's not, to me, very exciting. But I miss the talk in the firehouse. I miss the languaging that goes on. I miss the being out in the street and not knowing what's going to be there when you go. You know, that is a very exciting part. I was reading recently that there's a kind of a very primitive need that we have in I was reading this in an essay, a psychologist essay on roller coasters, believe it or not, that human beings have a primitive need for excitement. It comes from hundreds of thousands of years we spent as hunters in developing the human psyche. And so this primitive need for excitement is not fulfilled anymore. And I guess that's what I feel. I feel that need for the excitement of going to something that you don't know what's going to be there, and when you get there, you don't know what you're going to do.
That sounds like why I became a firefighter.
Yes.
Dennis Smith, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Leanne.
My guest has been former firefighter Dennis Smith, author of the best-selling report from Engine Company 82. His new book is called Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.